60-70% of our housing is built by these community builders. It's the backbone of our market. And when they can't get money because they don't have the deep balance sheet, they don't have the big pockets, deep pockets that some of the national builders do, it has a direct impact on our production. And that's what we've seen.
Welcome back to the Housing Advocate Podcast, presented by the Southern Utah Home Builders Association. My name is Stacy Young. I'm your host and the Government Affairs Director for the Southern Utah Home Builders Association. We're back for another great episode on housing policy today. We have the pleasure of sitting down with Steve Waldrop from the governor's office. I'm going to allow him to tell you his full title. I don't have it mastered yet, but Steve was recently appointed by the governor to a new role, and really excited to talk to him today about some of what that what his role represents, what some of the initiatives are that he's most excited about, and also to tell us a little bit about some of the recent laws that were passed in the legislative session that just ended last week. So thanks for coming to the show today, Steve, making time to sit down with me for a minute.
Thank you, Stacy. And my title is a mouthful. It's Senior Advisor to the Governor for Housing Policy and Housing Strategy and Innovation. It is a mouthful. And I've been in this position just since first week of December, so it's still relatively new to me. And we just finished our legislative session on Friday, so I'm still recovering from the brain damage that's we all suffer during that 45-day process.
It is a marathon. It is a marathon. Yeah, and we had the pleasure of just hearing from you now. You came down and spoke to our full membership at our monthly luncheon today, and so I just had the pleasure of hearing some of this. But for the listeners that were not in attendance at our luncheon today, could you maybe tell a little bit about your background, how you came into this role? It's a very interesting and perfect background, I would say, for what you're doing now.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a former attorney. I tell people I'm a recovering attorney. I only practiced law for 9 months, so my apologies to you, Stacy. But I tell people I got religion and got out. That's not really true. I practiced law and realized really quickly that I wasn't smart enough to do that for very long. And so I got into real estate development and worked for the Boyer Company for 14 years doing largely commercial and industrial in Ogden. And then in 2014, got out of that to be a little less busy and do some consulting work. And we started, co-founded a social benefit fund called the Rocky Mountain Homes Fund that is designed to help get our working professionals into home ownership. So very similar to what I'm doing now, but kind of on the private side. So we created that fund. During that time, I was asked to run for the legislature, and after some initial hesitation of why I'd inflict that brain damage on myself, I decided it was good public service, and it kind of made sense for, you know, the role I wanted to play in the community. I wanted to do something that could make a difference and felt like I had something to offer there. So I spent 4 years as a representative in the Utah House, and then left that 2 years ago, didn't run 2 years ago, and was focused on the Rocky Mountain Homes Fund, scaling that up. It's now about $100 million fund operating throughout the state. So that's been really successful. I left it with a really good management team that's in place, and they're still running it. I'm out of that role now. And the governor asked me to come and take this new position that they'd created to focus on housing. The governor had done this with homelessness a few years ago and asked former Senate President Wayne Niederhauser to come in and focus on homelessness coordination, because we had so many disparate things going on in homelessness. And I think they saw the success that Wayne has had in that role, and they wanted to do something similar with housing. So that's the task. And on the day I was hired or introduced, my first day on the job, I saw the poster that had 35,000 starter homes in the next 5 years on it. And I looked at that and said, oh, I had no idea that was what I was going to be doing for the next 5 years. So it works out to about 0.8 per hour, in case you're wondering.
Okay.
So it's not a small task. But that's the governor's focus. He's fully invested in this. He has given me both his complete confidence and his support politically through the legislative process. We got some difficult things accomplished and pushed some people to do things that are hard. this last session. And so it ended up being a very successful session, I think, when it could have been, because the budget was so tight, it could have been really difficult to do anything meaningful.
Yeah. No, it's great. I appreciate you hearing that background. I think it's very encouraging to have that leadership from the governor, straight from his office, and creating this role and appointing such a capable person to lead out on it. It's reassuring to know that the crisis is not going unnoticed at the very highest levels of government within our state. So as you mentioned the 35,000 starter home challenge, a lot of people have heard a little bit about that. Take us a little bit beyond the headlines there of what that sort of stands for, what kinds of homes we're talking about, how that dovetails with kind of our larger supply needs, you know, either the shortage or not that we have more broadly.
Yeah, good question. So if you looked at a graph of our creation of homes in Utah of all types, apartments, condos, townhomes, single-family detached, row houses, whatever are being built, prior to the, we were building a lot right up until the 2008-2009 recession. When that happened, we had a market crash, and everybody remembers that, particularly in the home building business. There's a lot of people that have a lot of scar tissue from that, because it created a huge correction in the market, and there were some really things out of balance at the time that we were doing with financing, with other things that we've corrected. And after that period of time, we stopped building largely for 3 or 4 years. Our production went to just a fraction of what it had been before. And so that created a housing deficit in our state and in our nation. This is not just in Utah, it's nationwide. And that housing deficit has persisted. And we saw the impact of that during COVID when all of a sudden, everybody had access to time because they could work anywhere in the country. They could work remotely. All of a sudden, remote work was a thing, and housing became under huge demand. Money was virtually free. Mm-hmm. The Fed had dropped interest rates down to, where people were getting 2% and 3% mortgages, and so you had this massive rush on the market. And with this rush, we had a limited supply from that time when we hadn't been building, and so prices went up. Anytime you have a low supply and a high demand, prices are going up. And so we had this massive spike in prices. And we're now dealing with the after effects of that. We still have a shortage. Interest rates have come back up. But as a result of higher interest rates and constrictions on our lenders by their federal regulators, we now have a production drop. Over the last 2 years, we built 37,000 new homes in 2021, housing of all types. In 2022, we were at 30,000, and 2023, we're at 19,000 and change. And 2024, we're projected somewhere in the 14-15 range. And our break-even point just to meet demand in Utah is 28,000. Mm-hmm. So we had a deficit. We were catching up on it. We built 37 and our demand's 28, so we were plus 9,000 that year, and that helped us start to catch up. But then last year, we lost 8,000 to what we need, and this next year, we may lose another 14,000-15,000 if things don't change. If we don't make some different structures available, if we don't create different mechanisms for financing and development, we will go back to a deficit of some 50,000 units. Which does not help pricing at all. It right. Hurts our pricing.
Yeah, it's devastating to it. Yeah, you have more money chasing fewer units, and the inevitable consequence is that increase in price. So the 35,000 then is sort of a subset of that larger deficit then. Is that kind of how you think about that?
Yeah, exactly. So we need housing in every category.
Yeah.
We need rental homes, we need low income, we need high income, we need medium income, we need starters. But I think the governor wisely chose to focus on something that we can all relate to, which is the need for first homes. Mm-hmm. We all have stories of friends or personal experience with children, grown-ed children, some married, some probably should be married, living in basements right now. And I think I asked in that meeting, I think we had probably 60% of the people raise their hands, and I think the other 40% were either shy or lying. So.
Right.
Everybody knows somebody who's got an adult child that can't afford housing right now. Mm-hmm. And so when the governor kind of looked at the policy, you know, the spectrum of policy approaches, that became the easiest one to get the message out about housing, because that's a need that everybody recognizes. It's something that hits home for most of us.
Yeah, I think that's great. It does really kind of center the problem around a really recognizable issue and cohort that, yeah, like you said, we're all experiencing. We all have someone in our family or that we know very closely, or our neighbor, you know, that we see or whatever. So we know a lot of that sort of informal doubling up is happening, that people would probably prefer different living arrangements if they could afford them. So to kind of shift from that kind of overarching goal and the challenge that we're trying to meet to some of the steps we're starting to take to try to fill that gap, can you walk us through a couple of those? Maybe they tie into current legislation, maybe they're beyond that.
Yeah, no, some of the issues we're dealing with are relative to interest rates, and obviously we can't control interest rates. You know, if we choose to, we can subsidize them. We created last year the First Time Home Buyers Assistance Fund. That was President Adams in the Senate did that and created a $50 million fund that is dedicated to helping people get into their first home. So they have to be first time home buyers. They can get up to $20,000 of assistance. And that can be used for rate buy down or down payment assistance or fees. So that's something that happened last year. And the intent of that was to sort of give builders the confidence that there would be someone on the other end, that interest rates wouldn't keep them from building those homes. And the target price for those statewide was $450,000. And that's a pretty high price for a starter home. That's, for most people, that's not a starter home. And so when we looked at what we need to do, we thought, okay, the first thing we need to do is define what a starter home is. And so that's, we've kind of settled on a broad target of $350,000 as a starter home, a starter unit. It could be a condo, a townhome, or a single family detached. And that really is going to depend on the location. Mm-hmm. Land price really drives the difference between those types of units. Construction costs are relatively the same yep. across the board. It's just when you get into the land, yeah. how dense do you have to be? Do you have to be condo dense? Do you have to be townhome dense? Or can you be small lot, single family dense? Mm-hmm. And so we're allowing any of those to qualify. And then what we have created is something to combat the liquidity issues that the financial markets are dealing with right now, our lenders, banks in particular. So we had three of the four largest bank failures, I think, or three of the five largest bank failures in the history of the country last year. And as a result, the Fed tightened lending restrictions on our community banks. They tightened them on all banks, but it hit our community banks particularly hard because at the same time, their restrictions were being tightened down and they were basically back to one-to-one lending. For every dollar that they took into deposits, they could lend $1. Mm. And they're used to lending $2 or $3.
Right.
But you know, to de-risk things, they tighten that down. And so our community banks are all operating at 90%+ of their lending capacity. And that has hit our smaller builders most acutely. Mm-hmm. And by smaller, I mean our non-national builders. These are right. our community builders, yep. You know, the people that live next door to you.
The majority of our members.
And the majority of the Utah market is mm-hmm. is built, 60-70% of our housing is built by these community builders. It's the backbone of our market. And when they can't get money because they don't have the deep balance sheet, they don't have the big deep pockets that some of the national builders do, it has a direct impact on our production. And that's what we've seen. We've seen that our production has fallen off, and we have a lot of builders that are kind of riding the tail end of the 2021, you know, boom time. And now they're staring at the future and looking at kind of bleak prospects because there isn't the next wave lined up because financing is so tight. So what we wanted to do is create liquidity for those builders in particular. We wanted to focus on our community builders and giving them an opportunity to do what they do and build homes and build communities and continue to serve as the backbone of our construction industry. And, you know, the great fear is if we lose, you know, if we go through another kind of builder recession and we lose a lot of our smaller builders, then that will not help pricing going forward either.
Right.
So we created a liquidity fund out of our Public Treasures Investment Fund. And we took a piece of that, carved it off, and put $2.5 billion in a separate account. And the first tranche of that that's available is $300 million. And that's available to lenders to get deposits from the state treasurer to deposit in their institutions. And in order to qualify for those deposits, there has to be a qualifying project. And a qualifying project is defined as one that has 60% of its homes at that attainable price, that $350,000 plus or minus price. They have to be owner-occupied and deed-restricted for owner occupancy for at least 5 years. And the municipalities can make it longer than that, but they have to do a minimum of five. And those qualifying projects will create an opportunity for builders to access funds, not only just to get access to funds, but also at a lower rate. They're going to be the deposits to the banks and credit unions will be at 3.5% right now, a little bit less than 3.5%, and then they can loan the money at a 3.5% profit. So that means our builders and developers will be able to get money at below 7%, which is a huge advantage, given that, you know, most of the money out there now is coming in at 8, 9, 10, 11, 12% right, even in some cases.
And much higher if it's equity, of course. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. One other follow-up question on that. So is there, you mentioned some of the unit level standards around this program. Are there minimum unit counts or projects scale?
No, this is available for any size project. There is no minimum. There's no maximum. Again, we want it to be market driven. You know, if you've got a lender and a builder that has a, you know, a five unit little infill piece they want to do, they should be able to do it. That's, again, that's, you know, such a huge part of our economy. We didn't want to limit it to just large-scale projects and have, you know, that be an additional squeeze on our community builders.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And it kind of gets into something that I think about quite a bit. You know, there's different ways of kind of segmenting the production side of the market. And one of them is sort of between the larger greenfield type of project. And in Southern Utah in particular, we have an abundance of those. I was counting it the other day, and I think we have north of 15 projects that are larger scale. And I would say that, you know, the floor of that's probably at least 500 units, and probably the median of those projects is closer to 3,500. And so those are going to kind of operate on their own logic. They have the different entitlement processes, different financing associated with them. But it seems like, especially given the crisis, we have another important channel to open up that I don't think is being tapped as much as it could be today in most cities, is more the brownfield, you know, redevelopment, infill type of approach that may be a smaller scale and may actually fit really well with just what you're saying. Are so much of the strength on our production side are these smaller community builders. Those are the kinds of projects that may be really suitable for that segment of the market. So this sounds like a really good program along those lines. Do you have any other thoughts about how policy might be better aligned to open up that channel of things?
Yeah, one other thing I'll just mention is that in the legislature that just concluded, we created, or the legislature created, a home ownership promotion zone. I got to get that name right, HOPZ, a home ownership promotion zone. And that HOPZ is a mechanism for the cities to use where they can get tax increment for a small, you know, less than 10 acre kind of infill project is kind of the intent of that,
okay,
to help drive some of that, because those decisions are largely local. I mean, you've got to have knowledge of the landowners. You've got to have, I mean, those are the things that our local builders really do well, is they know the landowners. They've been watching these pieces of land for years in some cases, and they're waiting for the right opportunity. And we want to have, you know, want them to have the capacity to jump on those and be able to get into those kind of projects and be able to have financing that they can deliver the projects.
That sounds like a great, great potential tool. I hope we see a few cities take us up on that potential. Are there any other new laws that you would like to underline for our listeners?
Yeah, I think the other one I think that for your group that would be potentially important is HB 13, which is the infrastructure reinvestment zones. And that is a tool where the developer, without the city's participation, so this is after the city's signed off on everything, they've approved the plans, now it's time to create infrastructure. The builder developer can go to the bonding market and use the city's bonding rating to issue bonds for that infrastructure. And typically that'll save a point to 2 points off of the cost of that infrastructure. It's going to depend on the project and the bond issuer and the builder and, you know, all of those factors. But it's an inexpensive way or a less expensive way to do infrastructure. And it doesn't impact the cities. The cities don't have anything to risk at that. It really operates just like normal financing on on the infrastructure. But it's just a way to get it at a lower rate, again, to drive toward our ability to deliver more affordable housing.
Yeah. I think the other advantage to that law is that it is very similar to standard development financing, lot financing. But one nice feature to it as well is that you're able to spread that cost across your entire project. So, you know, in your typical your typical term of a conventional, you know, development loan is going to be 18 to 36 months typically. And so you're usually looking at just a phase or two for your underwriting purposes. And that just is a whole different ballgame than if you're able to rationalize, especially kind of that large offsite type of infrastructure, that core infrastructure that projects need on the front end of things. Maybe just to wrap up, I'd just like to open the floor a little bit and just let you opine on our situation as you see it, as you come into this role and how you're feeling, to even a temperature check of how optimistic or not you are. And yeah, just kind of let you lay out how you see things.
Yeah, I've been accused of being a little bit of a chicken little, and I'm okay with that. I think that housing ownership is one of the cornerstones of our society, and we're at a real risk of losing that opportunity for a generation. If you look at the numbers right now, we have some 80% of our renters that can't transition into ownership. It's probably actually a little higher than that when you factor in all of the costs of that, because people who can would have already mostly. Right. So we have this really looming crisis, and it's a generational crisis. If we don't get this right now, this won't hit for another 40 or 50 years. All of a sudden, you'll have generations that will come to the end of their productive working years and not have equity, not have been able to build wealth through home ownership. And one of the key statistics that just came out is that the median wealth or net worth of a renter is $10,400. The median net worth of a homeowner is $396,200. Mm-hmm. So there's a 40 times gap there. Mm-hmm. And so if you think about, you know, can we create 1,000 new home ownership opportunities? Well, you've now pumped $400 million into our economy. If you create 10,000 new units, it's $4 billion. Mm-hmm. So the 35,000 units represent, I haven't done the math, probably $14 billion, somewhere in that neighborhood,
right.
$13.5, $14 billion of value into the people. I mean, these are into homeowners. And so that's what creates our middle class. That's what creates the opportunities for our kids to go to school and have opportunity to achieve in their education, to have, I mean, homeownership just cuts across so many good things that we value. And if we lose that opportunity, we lose, you know, we slow down our marriage age goes up, as we've seen, our reproductive rate goes down, crime goes up, community engagement goes down, scholastic achievement, high school graduation rates go up with ownership. And really, it's stability is really the key to that. But the best stability you can do is to own your home and to have that. And then on the back end of that is the equity creation, the wealth generation is what's built our current economy. And if we lose that opportunity, I'm very afraid for, you know, a couple generations from now when they don't have that to fall back on. When you have, you know, extremely low net worth and then you retire, you start looking to the government to solve your problems. And that bus doesn't run very fast. And that's a huge problem. We see it in other countries and we do not need that problem here.
Yeah. No, it's actually wonderful to hear you not sugarcoat it and just put it in the terms that it really is a crisis. I feel the same way. I sometimes say if this isn't a housing crisis, I don't want to see one, because this is
very true.
It's really bad. I thought you made a really good point during the luncheon about how many of us would be able to buy back into the housing market on the terms that we're in. And so, you know, for those of us that are on the, you know, on the shore, seeing folks drowning, I think it's incumbent on us to throw them a life raft to try to solve the problem so that generations behind us can also experience the American dream. And I would say too, you know, I think we don't even have to look, you know, overseas. We can even look a couple of states to our west about what happens if you don't solve this. If you go from a 50,000 home deficit to a, you know, I don't know what their latest estimates are in California, but I know it's at least 10x that. And you know, you see them exporting their middle class left, right, and center, just like you're saying.
And their tax rates go up, yep, because you have service issues. I mean, you create all of those ancillary problems that come along with a lack of stability.
Yeah. You break your state, your cities, that way, absolutely. Yeah, kind of a fun metric. I've seen one guy create, he calls it his U-Haul index, and it's the price of renting a U-Haul from California to Phoenix versus Phoenix to California. And it's kind of a track of that migration of as their housing policy is effectively, you know, a house in Phoenix is Southern California's housing policy, you know, ultimately. And so we don't want to be in that situation as a state. We don't want to export our children, our middle class. We want to remain a vibrant and a complete state. So
yeah, we have excellent jobs here right now. But if our children can't afford to live here, then we're going to get other people to come in and take those jobs. And, you know, again, when you deal with kind of the NIMBY world and people say, well, this is going to, you know, density is going to ruin my way of life. My rejoinder to that is, no, the fastest way to ruin our way of life is to export all of our children.
Yeah.
Density is not going to kill your way of life. Losing your children and changing the structure and framework of our society will kill your way of life.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks again so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed the conversation and just couldn't be happier that you're in this role and that we have this kind of leadership coming from the governor's office.
Thank you. I'm actually incredibly optimistic about the possibilities in Utah. I think we of all people can solve this and can make a difference and change in a way that other states and communities aren't going to be able to, because we do have a people who are willing to do the right thing and sacrifice to do the right thing.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thanks for tuning in for another episode of the Housing Advocate podcast. If you like the program, don't hesitate to like, share with your friends, and make sure you join us again next month for another episode. Thanks for tuning in.